Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Marilis Castro, chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and your chair for tonight's program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our very special guest, Tani Cantil Sekaui, Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court. Chief Justice Cantil Sekaui was sworn into office as Chief Justice of California on January 3, 2011. She is the first Asian, Filipina American, and the second woman to serve as the state's Chief Justice. After former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger nominated her as Chief Justice on July 22, 2010, the California State Bar Judicial Nominees Evaluation Commission rated her as exceptionally well qualified for the position. At a public hearing on August 26, 2010, she was confirmed by the Commission on Judicial Appointments and in a general election on November 2, 2010, an overwhelming majority of voters elected her to that position. Chief Justice Cantil Sekaui chairs the Judicial Council of California, the Administrative Policy-Making Board, State of Board Courts, and the Commission on Judicial Appointments. She has served for more than 20 years on California appellate and trial courts. In 1990, Governor George Duke Majan appointed her to the Sacramento Municipal Court, and in 1997, Governor Pete Wilson elevated her to the Superior Court of Sacramento County. On the Superior Court, she presided over both criminal and civic assignments. In 1997, she established and presided over the first court in Sacramento dedicated solely to domestic violence issue. In 2005, the former governor nominated her to the Court of Appeal, 3rd Appellate District. Chief Justice Cantil Sekaui was also a member of the California Commission for Impartial Courts. She previously served as a member of the Judicial Council's Domestic Violence Practice and Procedure Task Force and chaired its Best Practice Domestic Violence Committee. Prior to her work in the court system, Chief Justice Cantil Sekaui worked as a deputy district attorney for the Sacramento County District's Attorney's Office and served on the senior staff of California Governor. She has also served as the president of the Anthony M. American Inn of Court, an organization dedicated to promoting civility, ethics, and professionalism in the practice of law. Born in Sacramento, Chief Justice Cantil Sekaui received her BA from the University of California, Davis, and her JD from the UC Davis School of Law. She is also a great debater and public speaker, winning many state and national awards. Please welcome Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court, Tani Cantil Sekaui.
Thank you. Thank you for that kind and warm introduction. It's a pleasure to be with you this evening and to join the great tradition of the Commonwealth. I'm happy to be here because I've heard so much about your organization and your speakers, and I'm happy that you invited me. I come to you today in a year of having just completed my first year as Chief Justice, in the fourth year of a fiscal crisis, and in a period where our governor has announced we are in a new age of government austerity. And so what I'd like to talk to you about today is the state of the judicial branch and the impact of the fiscal crisis. But before I do that, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the role of justice in our democracy and its hopes and dreams and its evolution in the time that I've been on the bench alone. But I want to start with something that is here in San Francisco. So if you went to the San Francisco Supreme Court, if you went to the building, and you went to the conference center, you would see an exhibit of 60 photos of our courthouses throughout the history of California. And the name of the exhibit is called Temples of Justice. And if you were an architect, you would look at that exhibit and you would see buildings from the turn of the century having to do with architectural styles of Victorian styles and neoclassical and Art Deco. If you were a social historian, you would look at those buildings and you would see the evolution of frontier towns to urban metropolises. If you were a preservationist, you'd say, are those buildings still standing? But what I want to share with you is what I see when I look at the history of the court buildings in California. And there are 60 core photos. So from every county, its original courthouse. And for San Francisco, two pictures, one pre and post the 1906 quake and fire, and then, of course, the Supreme Court building at the Civic Center Plaza. So what I see when I see these wonderful buildings is I see the collective hope of the early Californian residents who came here and decided to establish justice. And much like our founding fathers in 1787, the preamble to the U.S. Constitution talks about establishing justice. So when California became populated and our frontier people came here, amidst the business of finding land and setting up a family and home and hearth, they decided to build courthouses. They decided to establish justice. What I see when I see those buildings is I see how they are temples of justice, as was stated in the 1898 dedication of the courthouse in Placer. So I have a quote of the judge who was there on Independence Day who spoke about their temple of justice. And this is what he said about the court in Placer. This is our temple of justice. It is the repository of our titles, the fortress of our personal and property rights, the fountainhead of our school system, the registry of our births, marriages, and deaths, and its inmates, and I think that must mean me, the judge, we stand guard by day and night over the peace and good order of our communities. And so what I see in the building of those courthouses are people who were enthused with hope and who looked to fairness and justice, and who decided to build not just courthouses, but really when you see these buildings, they are monuments to democracy and monuments to justice. And that's where the Temples of Justice exhibit came from. And that's what I think of when I see those buildings. And when I see those buildings and when I travel to them, I realize that they were once placed in the heart of the community. And they were placed in the heart of the community for a reason, because they were symbolically the heart of the community and the town. Often they were the gathering place, and businesses grew up around the courthouse. And as we begin our construction and our process of rebuilding the courts, we are doing much the same and finding the same interest. So even though the courthouses of today are not exactly in the center of town, they are still the center of our hearts and the center of our hopes, because courts are places of last resort. They are places where people go hat in hand to find justice when they could not find it anywhere else in the community. They come to the courts. And so that's what I see when I see the courts, and I invite you to see the exhibit. But of course, since those courthouses, California has come famously far, and we are very, I think, cutting edge on how we've delivered justice in California. In fact, really, everything about California is a beacon for the nation. For decades, people have looked to the state, not only in all of our technology and our politics, but even in our delivery of justice system. And so when we look at our state, I think about the measure of excellence that we've become nationally and internationally. And a measure of our excellence is, quite frankly, how often the Supreme Court and the decisions at the Court of Appeal are mentioned in national or federal jurisprudence. Because there is a nod, and I believe, to our state bench and our state bar about how collectively wise and how collectively difficult issues we look at that we try to resolve that are then examples that feed the rest of the state. But apart from that measure of excellence, I think another measure of excellence is something that the Commonwealth Club understands very critically, and that is we have an unusual structure in California. Our judicial branch has not only the trial court level, not only the court of appeal level, not only the Supreme Court level, but we are more than just a collection of courts. We are a third coequal branch of government. And so what we have is the Judicial Council. The Judicial Council is the policymaking body of the judicial branch. And what it does is it makes sure that we have public access to the courts for all 38 million Californians, because we have a state that is as diverse as any other nation in the world. We have the largest judicial system. And because we have such a diverse population from a county like Alpine that has 1,200 people and two judges, to if you fell down I-5, you would find Los Angeles, which is, what, 600 judges and 10 million people. But the point is, as diverse as California's judiciary is, it meets the diversity of our state. And in order to ensure that there is equal public access across the state that isn't dependent on the wealth of your community, the Judicial Council exists to make those rules, to make sure that there's uniform treatment of all Californians in their hope to establish justice. And of course, the Commonwealth was instrumental in creating the Judicial Council, because in 1926, when the California Constitution was amended to include the Judicial Council, the Commonwealth Club helped put that on the map and helped support that initiative. And when people asked, why do we need a Judicial Council? What's the purpose of this entity that's being created in our Constitution? Two senators wrote the ballot argument for the creation of the Judicial Council. And I have the quote and why they wrote on the argument why it is we needed a Judicial Council. And it said, the senator said, "One of the troubles with our court system is that the work of the various courts is not correlated, and nobody is responsible for seeing that the machinery of the courts is working smoothly. So when it is considered that some rule or procedure is not working well, it is nobody's business to see that the evil is corrected. But with a Judicial Council," the argument continued, "whenever anything goes wrong, any judge or lawyer or litigant or other citizen will know to whom to make complaint, and it will be the duty of the council to propose a remedy." And that's what Judicial Council does. I chair the Judicial Council policy with 21 voting members, but a total of 31 members. And together, all of us collectively wrestle and arm wrestle over the greatest policy issues facing the state. Now, that's not the only measure of our success and why California and the judicial branch is a beacon of excellence nationally and internationally. The other thing I would posit about it is that we have incredible vision and wisdom, not only in our judicial leaders and our lawyers, but our elected leadership and our community leaders. And I say that because when I joined the bench 21 years ago, it was an entirely different place. And in the last 15 years of the existence of the judicial branch, three major things happened, and I call them the game changers. And they were, one, in 1997, we took away funding of the courts from the counties and made the general fund, the state fund, actually fund a third branch of government. Imagine that. 15 years ago, the courts were a line item budget in a county budget, in 58 county budgets. And when I was in Sacramento, we used to joke that we were right under sanitation, because that's sometimes how we felt we were treated in Sacramento County 20 years ago. In 1998, 1 year after state funding, which really brought us all to stability and raised the boat for every court and provided equal access across the state, the good people of California decided to give us unification. So what was once at the trial court level, 220 loosely confederated courts, the people of California voted to turn it into 58 superior courts to match the counties in California. Brilliant idea. One court, one county. And so what happened is municipal court and superior court were merged into one court. Human resource offices merged. There was such an efficiency then of use of money in one court and one office, and a streamlining of services to the public, that unification was heralded as a major game changer in the judicial branch's history. The third major change happened relatively recently, and that was in 2002, when, again, the legislature decided that the judicial branch should be in charge of its temples of justice. And so we were able and were given the authority to repair, to maintain, to modify, and to build our courts. And so we went about a business of assessing what did the court buildings look like. Over 500 of them, and what did they need to make them seismically safe and ADA accessible? And that's what we're in the process of doing. And so I like to think of these three major changes to the judicial branch. I call them really our structural foundation. It's what brought the third branch into being. It gave us our institutional identity. And of course, I always refer to Chief Justice Ron George, a brilliant man who presided over one of the most respected Supreme Courts for the 14 years of his time on the Supreme Court. I call the judicial branch the house that George built. And I say that because Chief George took the ideas of other chief justices, and he worked with three separate governors and three separate legislatures and hundreds of attorneys and judges and elected leaders, and he created this branch that we have today. And the branch we have today, I say, is 15 years young, and we are still in the process of making the house that George built into the home that Californians deserve. So we have much to lose in this fiscal crisis in our fourth year. We have something at stake here that I think we spent years building. And when you think of our budget and think that the judicial branch budget in the last 4 years has been cut by 30%, and you ask, well, what does that mean in terms of dollars? What it means in terms of dollars is that in the last 4 years, the judicial branch has been cut every year, baseline budget cuts, recurring cut of $653 million. Now, here's the cruel irony about the judicial branch. We have no control over our caseload. We don't get to pick our cases. And as the economy becomes worse, and as people lose homes and jobs and privileges and services, they expect the court to be open for them. But the courts are in there, too, being cut like any other service that exists in California. And when you think of the general fund, if you were to think about the state general fund and you look at the pie, the judicial branch is 2.4% of that pie. We are 2.4% of the general fund. And I'm going to tell you that with 38 million Californians, 2.4% is not good. It's not enough. But we're doing the best we can. We're continuing to try to bring about the same level of service to meet your needs, doing with a 30% across-the-board cut every year. That's what we're trying to do. And so, do we have stresses in our judicial branch? Absolutely. Is it time to change governance? I don't think so. Is it something that really is more about what is facing California, what is facing the nation, what is facing the world, is trying to make do with the resources we have? And so I submit to you that we are in a tremendous fiscal crisis. It is affecting the people on the street. And I'll just share a few stories that I know that are happening in the courts today that we see and are reported to me. And one of them, for example, is a self-represented litigant, a pro per, a pro se, who can't afford to hire a lawyer. And so he goes to court every day to get help from the self-help kiosk that the Judicial Council mandated in all courts, that you have a self-help kiosk for people who cannot help themselves and can't understand the system. And this man goes to court every day, and he gets in line for the self-help kiosk. And every day that he gets in line for a while, they shut because we've had to reduce our hours at the self-help kiosk, because we don't have enough money. We have to spread around that $650 million cut. So their hours aren't open of the kiosk. So he has to take the bus home. He goes back the next day, and he's lucky if he can get to the self-help kiosk in order to fill out his paperwork. I understand he eventually did learn to fill out his paperwork, but when he got to court, it was closed, because the hours are reduced, because we don't have enough money to be fully operating and open all the time. So this man had to go home and go back and start again the next day. And the saddest thing about this is this man uses his food money for bus money because he's on a fixed income. So when he has to go to court, he doesn't get to eat lunch. And he has to come back over and over again because the lines are so long and the hours are truncated. We're seeing probably the greatest impact of the cuts in family law. Because family law is civil, and because civil cases don't have a constitutional obligation to be heard at a regular time, we're seeing courts set out civil cases months and months and months out. So we've seen situations where in custody disputes or a need to change custody that the judge can't get enough information from reduced staff, so he or she has to put the case out months and months out in advance until they can get the information. Meanwhile, it's been reported to me in San Diego, for example, that families are living in shelters or in their cars until they can get their custody order changed. The same is true with child support. In Placer County, I've heard the story where a man who was earning $60,000 a year had his child custody support, or his support order set at that amount. Well, he lost his job, and he had to go back to court to have that changed. But it took him 6 months before he could get into court because of the backlog. And by then, he still had to pay his child support, and so he lost his apartment. I mean, we are talking about long lines mean things to people. It means things to those people who don't have a vacation day or a sick day to come to court. So when they come to court on those days and they lose out because their case can't be heard, it means that they do without that month on 1 day of pay or 2 days of pay. So what we're seeing and what we're trying to convey to the legislature is the dire straits that the judicial branch is in trying to reach the neediest families and children. We have a lot to lose in the fourth-year cut of our fiscal crisis, and we are not a service that can be deferred. We need to help people now as their institutions no longer serve them. So in my first year, and as I traveled 30,000 miles up and down the state listening to judges and lawyers and parties and litigants and elected leaders, community leaders, I've come away with four general guidelines for the immediacy of my time on the bench as Chief Justice. And the first is to keep the courts open. You know, it's sort of a sad state of affairs when I come into the office and my goal is to keep courts open. I've joked with people and asked, what was it like when we had money? What was it like when we weren't cut year after year after year after year? What was it like before we had mid-year budget cuts every 6 months, so we're back with a red pencil every 6 months at the judicial branch budget? So, of course, my first order of business is to keep the courts open. My second order of business is to strengthen us from within. There are issues of governance in the judicial branch. I don't deny those, but this is not the time to change those. This is the time to work together to find funding so we can best serve the public. My third guiding principle is to coax the judicial branch. I think lift has been used before, the judicial branch, into the 21st century with technology. Because I believe if we get people online, we can keep them out of line. And if we can get people online, people will have more access and more time in court to try the cases that need to be tried. And lastly, an issue that and a guide that I really enjoy and look forward to developing is to pursue more civics education for California. And so I've joined with the ABA and I've joined with the federal bench to create a program to try to expand civics education with a summit, hopefully in September. Because as you know, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman on the United States Supreme Court bench, has made this part of her, I think, commitment in life after the bench. And she comes up with statistics that say things like 15% of the population can identify Chief Justice John Roberts as the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. And that sounds really good. But in that same poll, 66% of the people asked could name all three judges of American Idol. She also gives a statistic that fewer than half of the people polled can name the three branches of government, but 3 out of 4 people can name the Three Stooges. So we have work to do, and it will inure to all of our benefits to increase civics education about a third co-equal branch of government, that branch of government that serves as a check and balance on the other power and authority of the governments that exist to serve the people. And that's my commitment to this state for the next 12 years. Thank you.
Our thanks to Tani Kantil Sakaue, Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court. I'm Professor Jeffrey Brand, Dean of the University of San Francisco School of Law, and honored and proud to be moderating this panel and discussion with our new Chief Justice. This really is an honor.
Thank you, Dean Brand.
To paraphrase a great blues singer, so many questions and so little time, they've been flooding the table. So let's get right to work. First of all, you've described the administrative structure of the court, and a lot of your time is spent advocating for the courts and in that administrative function. You've been described as a great multitasker. Could you describe your duties generally on the court in addition to sitting and hearing cases and deciding them?
Thank you. Yes. I often describe my coming to understand the role of the Chief Justice as wearing three hats. And, of course, I would first preface this answer by saying it is true that it's hard to have a plan when you become Chief Justice. It's as if the problems find you, and then you get to sort them out and prioritize them as needed. But overall, the Chief Justice's role has three roles. And the first is Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, meaning I sit with six other jurists, and together we decide the most difficult, novel questions of law facing California and sometimes the Ninth Circuit. So we actually do a serious amount of research and development of the law. It's a lot of statutory interpretation. And second hat that I wear as Chief Justice is I chair the Judicial Council. The Judicial Council is the constitutional policymaking body of the branch. I think it is what distinguishes us as a third branch of government because we are a body that is constitutional, that's role is to provide statewide policy and uniformity. Of course, that role is in tension with the fact that of the 58 trial courts, they are elected judges, and they elect in their county a presiding judge, and the presiding judge then picks or has an elected executive committee. So the courts themselves, the 58 trial courts, have a fair amount of autonomy, as they well should. They control their own budget. They make their own decisions. They decide whether they want to set up military veterans combat courts or elder abuse courts or domestic violence abuse courts, because every court in every county should and does cater to its community's legal needs in their county. And so there is a lot of independence. Nevertheless, attorneys need uniformity. They need to know what it costs to file motions. They need to know upon what form or what color paper the motion should be. And the Judicial Council ensures that access is uniform. We make sure we follow, we pass uniform rules. We pass statewide initiatives. We will decide that pro se litigants, self-represented litigants, need more attention and more help statewide this year than any other. And we will make efforts and mandate certain laws that courts must follow. So we are really a policymaking body. That's a very busy job because it involves at least 400 volunteers who assist and populate the advisory committees. So Judicial Council makes its decisions based on advisory committees. There are at least 22 advisory committees and multiple working task forces and blue ribbon commissions. They're populated with subject matter experts, lawyers who are experts in elder law, lawyers who are experts in complex litigation asbestos. And together, those subject matter experts, they come up with proposals to improve the law, and then those trickle up to the Judicial Council, and we debate whether or not that should be a uniform rule or a uniform best practice. We also at Judicial Council handle the budget. When the legislature appropriates the money from the general fund to the judicial branch allocates the money to the 58 trial courts, the six courts of appeal, and the Supreme Court. Now, the Judicial Council is made up of judges and lawyers, and we all have day jobs. So we have a staff arm. Our staff arm is called the Administrative Office of the Courts, or the AOC. And there are about 800 of those folks in the AOC, and they do, for the Judicial Council, all of our policies that we order are executed. But the AOC also does for the courts what they cannot do for themselves. So remember when I said 20 years ago the courts were under the auspices of the county. So when I worked in the courts and I needed something, I would go to the county and they would take care of it. For example, when I was in trial court, if I was sued and I received the complaint and summons, I would walk over to the county board of supervisors and hand them the summons and complaint, and they would take care of it in the county. Also, my paycheck, signed by the county. The county was the administrative arm for the courts on a lot of ministerial tasks. But when the state took over funding from the county and became the sole source of funding for the trial courts, the counties bowed out. Now, some counties couldn't do payroll, some counties couldn't do human resources, some counties couldn't do litigation, and the AOC plugged in to perform those services for those courts that could not do it for themselves. So a lot of my job in my second hat or my second role is to oversee the AOC and the administrative director of the courts, as well as the policymaking of the Judicial Council, which I chair. My third role is really as the head of the judicial branch. So in that regard, I belong to the Federal State Judicial Council, where I meet twice a year, if not more, with my federal counterparts. And we talk about where the federal branch and the state branch can reach uniformity, efficiency, where we can inform each other of the work we do. My position in that third role is really one of what you would expect. If California is to show up and the judicial branch is to be represented, it would be me. And so I also then belong to an organization called CCJ, Conference of Chief Justices, where every state and has one chief. We meet twice a year to discuss those issues that face us in our state, those issues that face us federally, and those issues that are trends. And so I meet with all the chief justices, we organize committees, and we try to make sure that we get uniform access and uniform rules from the federal branch. So it is three hats, and it's unpredictable, and they happen at any time of day or night.
And I think it's fair to say that when you assumed your role as Chief Justice, burners were percolating in all of those areas. And, of course, one of the things that you confronted immediately was a budget cuts in the neighborhood of $637 million for the courts. And there's a lot of concern among those in the audience tonight about the budget and its impact on justice. And let me just start with two questions that I think frame the issue nicely. One question asks, what steps can individual lawyers or citizens take to support adequate funding for the judicial branch? And then another follows up with the pending Assembly Bill 1208. Which some characterize as actually increasing the autonomy of the courts and increasing funding, but which, if I'm understanding correctly, you have not supported at this point. And could you talk about funding, its relationship to pending proposals, and
yes,
what you see happening and how folks can help?
Let me start with the first part of your question and inadequate stable funding. Since the branch has been cut 4 years in a row, and since it's a baseline cut, what we've been able to do with Judicial Council, because we were wise in saving the money we had, and because the money we had at Council was set for statewide initiatives like our construction, like technology, when we were cut in fiscal year 11-12, $350 million, we were able to backfill of that $350 million, $300 million to the trial courts alone. So the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court and the Judicial Council AOC received no additional money, lived with the cuts. The AOC Judicial Council took a 12% cut, Supreme Court took a 9.6% cut, and the Court of Appeal took a 9.7% cut. Now, what can lawyers do? I've been up and down the state all last year asking for lawyers to give us their voice. Judges in the legislature, we don't bring votes, and we don't bring sway, and we don't bring campaign contributions. What we bring is a civics lesson about the importance of the rule of law and the separation of powers. So I found in my first year that our voice wasn't heard as loudly as it could be. So I asked lawyers to speak up for us. I pointed out to them that you represent the public, and the public can't access the courts if the courts aren't open. So you have a vested interest in ensuring that the courts are adequately funded. I sat down with three groups of, I think, lawyer leaders from Northern California, Central California, and Southern California. I went over our budget. We talked about what had happened, where we were. They saw the problem, and what did they do? They jumped into action. The state bar stood up, and they said, we'll staff a co coalition. The attorneys got together from Southern California to Northern California, and they created the Open Courts Coalition. I don't know if you've heard about the Open Courts Coalition, but they've done tremendous things. The first thing they did was they held a rally in Los Angeles, January 18, Stand Up for Justice. 300 to 400 people showed up on the streets of Los Angeles. Six speakers were there, from governors to legislators to union reps and union presidents, and they said, restore funding to the judicial branch. They are a check and balance in our democracy, and it got a lot of press. Also, the lawyers took a video of myself, Kamala Harris, George Duke Majan, Gray Davis, Art Agnos, a number of people, 30-second sound bites of what it means to underfund the judicial branch, and they made a video. They downloaded this video on Nooks. They bought 120 Nooks, and they delivered them to the legislature. And they downloaded it. They gave it as a gift. It said, press me. They pressed it. Up pops my head talking about we need money to fund democracy. And there was, and it's 4 minutes of that, and it's had a huge impact at the legislature. Not yet finished, the Open Courts Coalition, then they're meeting one-on-one with legislators. They're calling legislators. They're pointing out the narrative of what I've just told you about what the impact means on people. The lawyers from all walks of life have come forward to really speak about the need for adequate funding. And joined in that is business. The California Chamber of Commerce, CJAC, a number of business organizations have stepped forward to say, if we don't have stable justice in California, business is not served, because we need to get lawsuits off our books, we need to resolve our disputes, we need to move forward, we cannot live with this uncertainty. And so business has joined lawyers. Lawyers on both sides of the aisle who would never join hands have joined hands about funding. And so they've called legislators, they've written legislators, and they go to the legislature. I see them in the halls because I'm there as well. And so together they're delivering the message of a need for an open court. And if you have those kinds of connections or interest, that's what's happening in the Capitol. Many judges have also volunteered, and lawyers, and they've joined to create the Bench Bar Coalition. And they go to the legislature and bring the message and bring handouts. I think this is the first year that we've actually had that kind of coalescence. Now, AB 1208 is an entirely different situation. It's not about restoring adequate funding. What 1208 does is want to eliminate from judicial counsel the authority to have statewide initiatives. What 1208 does is fragmentize and undermine the three game changers that I talked about. What it does is it sets up a whole new way of funding the judicial branch trial courts and trial courts only. So when the money comes from the legislature to the judicial council, instead of letting judicial council make the budget decision, it would go directly to the trial courts. Now, let me tell you first how the judicial council budget decision is made. I don't make it. I don't decide it. I don't unilaterally tell Los Angeles County what their budget's going to be. Every year we bring together 30 people. 15 presiding judges from 15 counties and 15 court executive officers from 15 counties. These 30 people from the trial courts, leaders in the trial courts, they survey all the 58 courts. They ask them what your numbers were before. They look at the need, and they divvy up the trial court money that comes from the legislature. 30 independent people who stand to receive or lose as much as the other courts, they make a recommendation to judicial counsel about how to allocate that money. They do it in a public, transparent, anyone can speak at that meeting and plead their case, but those 15 presiding judges and those 15 CEOs do that responsibly because they know next year they may not be part of the group that makes the decision. They make the decision, they make a recommendation to council, and that's how that happens. Under 1208, that would not happen. Under 1208, the money would go from the legislature, be divvied up amongst the 58 trial courts. And you might say, that sounds good, why not do that? And I'll give you several reasons. And the first reason is that that's never been done before, never. The counties used to control the budget. So what you're doing is you're putting in millions of dollars to a trial court, to the presiding judge and the CEO. Presiding judges in trial courts turn over every 2 years. Every 2 years. So they have to learn and be conversant with budget and budget needs. And that's a difficult thing to do, I will tell you, because the budget's complex in California. But apart from that, remember when I told you about those self-help kiosks that help those people who cannot find lawyers, who we mandated in the 58 courts? Well, under AB 1208, that couldn't happen. You'd need to go to 58 courts and get their written consent if we could do a statewide initiative. And under AB 1208, as few as two courts could veto a statewide initiative. That means Los Angeles and one other court could just torpedo any other statewide action that exists out there. We also have in California through Judicial Council what we call the Complex Civil Litigation Program, where we give money to courts to handle the great big cases, the asbestos cases, the class action cases, and they bring their best judges to those kinds of cases, and we fund that. Under AB 1208, you can't have that. You'd have to go and get the consent of 58 different judges, and two courts could veto that. And I don't think that's what our frontier settlers meant when they said establish justice so that two courts could veto a statewide proposal. And they don't need to discuss it. They just need to say no. And here's probably the most important thing about AB 1208 to those of you in San Francisco. Earlier, the Judicial Council voted to give San Francisco $2.5 million of emergency money because they were finding that they were going under as a result of 4 years of fiscal cuts. Under AB 1208, we could not do that. It does not permit the Judicial Council or any other court to help another court out. I frankly do not know what it would mean if a court went under and they had to go to 58 courts to get agreement to be bailed out. That means Judicial Council could not have bailed out San Joaquin. San Joaquin was in a difficult situation. They needed $1.9 million. They came to the Judicial Council. It was publicly debated. We publicly looked at their books. We took an audit. We said, why are you in the hole? The same questions we asked of San Francisco. We made them both loans. And we said, these are loans because other courts may come to us and need bailing out. And this is not our money. This is their money. This is your money. Under AB 1208, it takes away the Judicial Council's authority to do so. Now, I could tell you another reason why AB 1208, I think, is a bad idea, and that is due process. AB 1208 has received no hearing on the language that exists now on the Assembly floor. When AB 1208 was first brought into the legislature by the Assembly member who introduced it, it was in one form of language. By the time it went to a hearing, they changed it verbally at the hearing. So we never had a hearing on the changes. When it went to the Assembly floor, it went through yet another change that never had a hearing. I frankly look at those changes. I've had to do a bill analysis myself. It's never been debated. The other thing I will tell you about AB 1208 is 44 presiding judges oppose it. So if it's so good for the presiding judges, if it's so good for the trial courts, I ask you why it is that 44 presiding judges oppose it. The 14 other presiding judges, they don't support it. They just won't publicly sign the letter, but they've said to me, some of them, that they will call because they personally oppose it, but they can't sign the letter. But 44 is a supermajority out of 58, and that's good enough for me. And my feeling is if you want to change governance, if you want to change the 15 years of the three game changers that the California voters voted on, fine. But let's have a hearing about it. Let's have a debate. Let's talk about what those changes mean. Let's bring everyone in. Let's have a hearing and talk about whether it's time for change. I'm open for that, but I'm not open to having two courts veto any statewide initiative.
Thank you for that comprehensive answer. Staying with the notion of the impact of a lack of funding on the courts, several people are concerned with its impact in particular on the criminal justice system. One of our audience members wondering about whether parole guidelines are more a function of escalating costs than concerns for due process. Another wondering about how monetary concerns impact criminal justice decisions, for example, in relation to the death penalty. Can you comment on the specific impact with regard to the criminal justice system and then maybe segue into what I think is a wonderful question that I hope every one of my students struggles with, which is, how do you define justice?
Oh, well, let me start with the easier one. I think this is a very savvy and wise crowd to look behind the wisdom and the purported reasons for legislation, because it is certainly true that the observations made about criminal realignment and release of inmates from prison to counties can certainly have appearance of financial concerns. And the same is true of cost of the death penalty. But here at the Supreme Court and in my role, and is the role of the judiciary and every judge, is we follow the rule of law. It's not our role to decide the wisdom of the law, except in passing to remark on it, I suppose, in interpreting a law. But that's the province of the legislature. They were elected to make the laws and the governor to determine whether or not these proposals are worthy of being signed into law. And they look at the wisdom and they look at what the community needs are. When it comes to the Supreme Court and as a judge of 21 years, I don't dwell too long on the wisdom and the means and the reason behind it because that's not my role and that's never the role of a judiciary. The role of the judiciary is to be impartial, look at precedent, look at the plain language, and if not the plain language, determine by legislative intent what the legislative history, what the intent is, and to implement the law. So I think that those are great questions, but I would tell you, really, at the Supreme Court level, we don't delve into that except maybe for cocktail talk. It doesn't enter into how we write the opinion or whether we think the law is right or just. In terms of really my definition of justice, I think justice is, the definition is elusive because it means different things to different people. But I certainly think that it has external factors that influence whether or not it's delivered. And what I mean by that is I've always seen the court system and my role as a judge, as a person who clears the deck and makes for a level playing field so you have a chance at justice. Because what A's version of justice in this case might be is different from what B's version of justice is. And I'm not going to be arrogant enough to tell you that I know which it is. I will tell you that my role is to do the heavy lifting in the beginning. When I'm a trial judge, what I do is I work through my law and motion. I decide what's admissible, what isn't. I lay the ground rules for the attorneys. And then I recede into the wallpaper. And I let them do what they were hired to do. I let them do what they were trained to do. And I get in the middle of it when I think that rights are being violated that are so harmful it will result in a miscarriage of justice. But otherwise, for me, justice is about a place. It's about giving you the opportunity to convince 12 people what your version is, not what mine is.
Thank you. You know, at the same time, there's concern about lack of funding and its impact on the courts. Some of the questions also express a concern about how money is being used by the courts. For example, one question wonders whether or not this kind of funding shortage, in fact, can actually make the courts more efficient. Another is concerned about proposed technology plans for the court that I've seen figures as high as $1.9 billion for an electronic case management system. And could you comment on that aspect of the budget crisis as
Happy
well?
To. Certainly, we have to reexamine our business model. Someone once joked to me that if John Adams came into the court today, little would be different from when he was in court. That might be true, but I think it is true that this is a time of fiscal crisis and it's an opportunity to look at how we proceed from here. What's our new model? And I think it's really a time to examine old assumptions and to find different ways to deliver justice. And I am open to that in many ways. And that's something that really has to come from the lawyers and the public that they represent to tell us judges how and why they think we can accomplish that. We know we judges think that we can find efficiencies, and we've been doing that over the last 4 years. The only way we've been able to stay open and deliver justice with a $653 million cut over 4 years is by finding those efficiencies. Are there ways that we can save money? Absolutely. Are there better ways of delivering justice? We're working on it. But I will say that in terms of technology, you mentioned a number of $1.9 billion. That's a number that means if we have a computer system that's up and running called CCMS, if we deploy it to 58 trial courts, it will then cost $1.9 billion. But right now it's cost about $400 million just to create it, and we own it, and it works. Is it efficient? Absolutely. Is it exciting? Yes, it is. Do we have enough money to deploy it? Don't know. We don't know, but we will know pretty soon in March or April when an independent report comes back that tells us what it costs to deploy it statewide. And when it tells us that number, judicial counsel will say, too much money, we can't go forward, or maybe this is a priority that we have to decide is something we need to use to go forward. But that's a decision that will happen at counsel, publicly, transparently, with input, public comment, before that decision is made. Of course, technology saves money. The question is, though, do we have the money to save the money today? And I would probably tell you today, as I stand here knowing the budget, we don't.
Thank you. I want to also remind our listening audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Tani Kantil Sakaui, Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court, who is discussing the challenges to the justice system. Of course, all of these funding issues raise very critical questions about your relationship to the other branches of government. And there's two questions here. I think they're the same question, but one is clearly more politic than the other. The politic one is, how is your relationship to the other branches of government? The less politic and more direct one is, how do you create leverage in your negotiations with Governor Brown concerning funding of the judicial system?
Great questions. Those are great questions. My relationship with the legislature, both the Senate side and the Assembly side, is good. I meet with them. We talk. I know how difficult a job they have, and I know they're balancing priorities, too. I mean, they have their own judicial council, so to speak, with their caucuses, where they have to make decisions about how to go forward and what they're going to vote for and what takes priority. So I respect the work they do. I know it's hard work, and that's what they're elected to do. And it doesn't help that I went to law school with Daryl Steinberg, who's the president of the Senate. That said, I think that they, too, recognize all of our difficult choices, and the governor, too. The governor is trying to balance priorities. I've met with him several times, and we talk about the realities of trying to govern in a state of reduced resources and prioritizing those things. And you know what? When we talk all together, we're also educating ourselves about our own issues and our own challenges in our houses, and that's always good. In terms of the question about how about leveraged with the governor, don't have it. The judicial branch isn't known for leverage. You know, really, when you think about it, the judicial branch has never been louder than it's been in the last year. Who has heard of us? And we've been judges toiling away in our darkened courtrooms, churning out the law happily. But in our fourth year of cut, and with a new chief, kind of come out swinging, because we can't take a fifth year and a sixth year. And so we need to get leverage. Our leverage really is the attorney groups, especially the pro bono legal services groups, the Legal Access Commission, because when they go to the legislature and they say our clients aren't being served because the courts aren't open or they had to reduce or cut back on this kind of case, people listen, because they tell the story of the real people who try to use the court services. But judges, we don't have leverage. I had a conversation with Governor Brown, and he said early on, he said to me, poor people have more leverage than you. And he's right. But the judicial branch isn't political, and we don't want to be. We just want stable, predictable funding so we can go back to our darkened courtrooms and churn out the law.
Well, and speaking of political, that's a good segue into the next set of questions, which relates to judges and the appointment of judges. You know, we have so many interesting topics to cover. This is great. Great questions from the audience. How political are judicial appointments in California? Is it important that a candidate for judge be of the same political party as the governor? And a related question is, in today's dysfunctional federal legislature, what thoughts do you have when the president's federal judicial appointments get stonewalled and not confirmed? What is the confirmation process for judges in California? So I guess the question really is the relationship of politics to judging, and is the process working here in California?
Thank you, Dean Brown. Let me preface that by telling you very quickly how judges become judges and how justices become justices. So when I say judge, I'm referring to trial courts. Those are the 58 superior courts in the state of California, of which there are about 1,700. You become a judge one of two ways. There is either a vacancy that you can run for elected office, so you run for office like any other elected office, or for most judges in California, you are appointed by the governor. And you fill out an application that talks about your history, your cases, and then you're evaluated by the state bar and you're given a rating, and then the governor gets to choose whether or not he wishes to elevate or appoint a lawyer to become a judge. Is that a political process? It really depends on the governor. We saw with Governor Schwarzenegger that he appointed people from both parties, that he appointed both prosecutor and defense counsel, civil insurance to state administrative background. So he was someone who actually didn't take into account party line. But we also know historically, if we go back in history to governors like Duke Majan or Wilson, we've seen more partisan appointments based on party. That doesn't mean anyone is more or less qualified. It just means, I think, that governor believes that person is more aligned with his philosophy about the state of California and government and justice. Now, to become a justice, which is the term that's used for appellate court justices and Supreme Court justices, it's a different situation. You can never run for that office. There's never a vacancy that you can run for. It does require you to be appointed by the governor, and then you have to be confirmed by the Commission on Judicial Appointments. That's a three group of people, the Attorney General, and the Chief Justice who chairs it, and then the senior presiding justice of that court of appeal or that Supreme Court. And so it's a different process where you are evaluated, where you are rated by the Jenny Commission, the Judicial Nomination Evaluation. And by that I mean your name goes out to 240,000 lawyers, and they get to write an anonymous evaluation of you. And then what happens in that interview is they list all your negative qualifications, and you get to rebut them on a tape recorder. And that goes to the governor. So it is a full evaluation, and everyone gets an opportunity to weigh in on whether or not they think you're qualified for the position. Is that a political spot, a justice of the Court of Appeal and a justice of the Supreme Court? Well, it is said, and it's probably true, and I've never been a governor, but judges and justices are a governor's legacy. It's what people remember about the governor. Term limits come and go, but judges stay around for careers and generations. And so is that more of a political process? You know, I'd have to say, in my experience, probably so. But it's a political process that's balanced by an objective analysis done by the state bar.
Great. I want to turn our attention a little bit to the spotlight on you and a little bit on your personal life, in the sense that here you are, the first Asian Filipina American to serve as Chief Justice, the second woman in the history of California to be the Chief Justice. And the question is asked, how did it feel to become the first Asian Filipina American and the second woman to serve as head of the state's judiciary?
You know, I have to tell you, I never quite dreamed this big. I was completely surprised to get the phone call to asking me if I was interested in becoming Chief Justice. And when I did get the call, of course, I thought, oh, they're compiling a list, and I'm going to be on the list. And it's like the Academy Awards. It's an honor to be considered. And sure, I'll go to the governor's office, and I'd like to sit down with Governor Schwarzenegger. And so I told my husband, you know, I'm happy to take the interview, but I know people who are eminently qualified, and I know who I'm rooting for. And so I took the interview, and I was very surprised at the end of the interview to have it offered to me. It comes as such a surprise, you don't really get to think about it. You just find your mouth saying yes. And then you leave the office and you ask yourself, what have I done? I live in Sacramento. I have two teenage daughters. What have I done? But then, you know, the the heavens aligned, and it made it possible for me to come here and to actually do this work and not really skip a beat. What it means to be Filipina first and the second woman, you know, I was a judge for 20 years before I came here. And, you know, 20 years in, I forgot that I was a Filipina woman. I just never thought about it. I showed up every day in my legal community. They know me. I know them. It's not a big deal. I wasn't even really all that conscious of it until I came to the state level at the Supreme Court, and I was happily reminded of it. And what does it mean? I don't know, because I've always been Filipina American and I've always been a woman, so it's always been the same experience for me.
You mentioned your family, and many articles written about you since your appointment discuss your apparent and real ability to balance work and life. Several colleagues, writes one member of the audience, several colleagues have applauded you for remaining a devoted mother and wife, even with your busy schedule. Do you have any advice for the audience and for our listening audience on maintaining balance between work and family?
Thank you. Well, I think balance assumes a fact, not an evidence.
Well, you have us fooled.
But the truth is I love my work, and so it's also a bit of my hobby. So I really have work and family. And I'm always reading, so my kids are in sports, and I'm the mom who always has the iPad and the briefs. And I'm the mom at Girl Scouts who's squirreled in the corner reading my briefs and talking to people. It's just it just seems that there's a lot of down moments, especially with teenagers, because it seems to me, you know, in the beginning, your children want to marry you. You're the center of their life. And then when they become teenagers, they hardly talk to you unless they need a ride somewhere. So I'm at that stage. And that's what I mean is, you know, in the half of the week, they're very busy. So that's the balance in some respects. But the advice I have is to not make sacrifices along the way. You have to be true to the environment and situation you're in. And when I was a mom of young children, I took an assignment that didn't require me to be in jury trial, so I wasn't responsible for 12 people every day. I ran a huge calendar court, and all I was responsible for was about 200 people a day and lawyers. And so I knew lawyers appreciated me saying, look, got to pick my kid up at 5, so chop, chop. And when they knew that they were in my court, they knew they could pick their kid up at 5, too. It was a matter of taking the kinds of assignments that facilitated my schedule, even though they weren't the glory assignments, but I enjoyed them. And it got me through that time where they got to be teenagers, and I became less physically important to them.
There's many specific questions around specific topics that we're not going to have time to get to, but I do think people are very interested in how you would describe your judicial philosophy. It's been said that you're a moderate, that like Chief Justice George, you rule from the center. Can you describe what you think your judicial philosophy is?
I'll give it a try. I think my judicial philosophy is one that's really grounded in my experience as being a trial judge for 14 years, and that is that I'm very open-minded about listening to the argument. And I have several, I think, precepts that I follow, and that is, what's the law, and what does it mean, and how does it apply to these facts? And in that regard, I'm pretty grounded in procedure, and I'm pretty grounded in looking at the words and the intent. And I would say I'm moderate because I think that I try to apply the law the way it's meant to be interpreted, which is plain, clear meaning. And if I find myself in legislative history to determine what the law means because it's not clear from the language of the text, I find myself trying to opt for what is the most common sense, obvious answer, the direct and simple answer to that. And if I find myself doing mental gymnastics to get there, I'm pretty uncomfortable because I think the legislature makes laws for average folks, and they are trying to make a better government, and certainly all these gymnastics weren't meant for me to find the meaning to this. So if you've looked at my writings or my dissents, you'll see that I start from a pretty civil procedure anchor to get there.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's only time for one last question, and maybe this is an appropriate last question. You've had wonderful words for Chief Justice George and all that he did for California's judiciary. 20, 30, 40, God, it could be 60 years with you, God, you know. What would you like your legacy to be on the court?
Thank you. That's a good question. I think I'd like my legacy on the court to be that during its roughest financial times, the court came together with its legal community and sought to, unlike our frontier Californians, establish justice, but to preserve it. And that my legacy is that during my tenure, that Californians began to know and appreciate the importance of the judicial branch and how it is a fundamental precept of democracy, and to appreciate that we're here to resolve the bitterest of disputes. And so I would also like my legacy to be sort of like my legacy at home, and that is I'm pretty efficient, want to be organized, want to have good priorities and know where I need to spend my time and not waste time. And to the extent that the judicial branch could use some better organization or greater efficiencies to make the system work smarter, faster, and be more flexible and more accessible, I'd like to be the Chief Justice who institutes those kinds of changes.
Thank you. And our thanks to Tani Kantil-Sakaui, Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court. In particular, Chief Justice, our thanks for reminding us of the importance of an independent judiciary to the health and well-being of our democracy. I know that we at the University of San Francisco School of Law and that every dean and of every law school in this state salutes that commitment which inspires our work. I'm Dean. We also thank, of course, I would be remiss not to say this, our audience is here and on radio and television and the Internet. So I'm Dean Jeffrey Brand of the University of San Francisco School of Law, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.